to the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Welcome to the first episode of the USDF's weekly podcasts, and we begin with a series called Ask the Experts with the presenters of the 2011 symposium, Jeremy Steinberg, Debbie McDonald, Scott Hassler, and Anne Gribbons.
We've been getting a lot of questions from you guys, and they're great questions, so we appreciate that. I know one that's come up actually a couple of times. I think this was a good example, which I'll throw out to these guys. Started out a little bit behind the vertical. So I'd say to you guys, like, what's the plan with that? How are we going to address that? Do we address it? What do we say about it?
Well, we also tend these days to get top line or frame fixated. And that has come a little bit from all the lengthy discussions about the roll cure and all this. But, you know, every horse is built his own way. And we'll need a little bit different treatment.
I think last comment to wrap up the morning is that, particularly in young horses, there are so many things that are varying. Their energy, their emotion, their concentration, their muscles, you name it. We wish it could be more simple to say, do this, don't do that. Unfortunately, that's not the way it is. You have to really work with each horse and with each situation you're in at the moment. They change so dramatically. And, frame is a great question. However, it can only be demonstrated in working with horses, not as a general rule, because there's so many things that can change in that. Also, tempo and, as Debbie said, rising sitting work. I mean, some horses... Honestly, there's some horses I don't stretch. I'll be open about that. I love to stretch horses as a reward. But there's some horses when they stretch. There's some horses that stretch that just really get sloppy and don't use themselves. And there's not a purpose for it at that stage. They might stretch again in 6 months and be positive. But sometimes it's just not productive. So everything we do has to be thinking. Productive, working with the young horse, getting their confidence, developing them. And overall, this is the fun. The fun is to help these become our future athletes, that we show them the way.
Jeremy, I have one here that maybe you would like to address. And it's on Morgan's mare, the fact that she is a little long-backed.
Mm-hmm.
And some thoughts on some exercises to strengthen a long-backed horse, other than lots of transitions.
Yeah. So you guys heard the question, right? It's one thing that, like when I said in the beginning with her, is a very typical build for a mare. A little bit long in the hind leg, a little bit longer, weaker in the back, which can create a lot of times the tension, or that innate tension, is just the innate weakness that's there. So people ask me that, and I would ask you guys also maybe to chime in on that, because I know there's a lot of things. People say, oh, I do hill work, I do this work, I do that work, and all this other strength building work. But I really tend to think quiet work is the best thing you can do. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's transitions, it doesn't matter if it's hill work, it doesn't matter if it's Cavaletti work. What you have to think is, what do I want strong? How do I isolate it? And does this thing that I'm doing make that part of the body work so it can get stronger? So one thing we have to really think is when it comes to muscle building, is it like, I think it's like a dressage myth. When a muscle is stretched, it's not being built stronger. It's being stretched looser. When the muscle is flexed is when it gets built stronger. It has to contract to get stronger. It can still tear when it gets the muscle builds by making little micro tears in the muscle. As those micro tears fill with fiber, that's your muscle growth happening. So in order to build muscle, you actually damage the muscle on a micro level. The correct type of muscle damage that you have to have happens in a moment of contraction. Of the muscle squeezing together. When the muscle's stretched out, it can also tear. It tears in the wrong way, but it can also tear. But the stretching does not build muscle. It loosens muscle. It makes it that the range of movement in the horses is greater, so that through that greater range of movement, the horse can bend the joints more, take on more weight, lift the back higher, do whatever it is that you need the horse to do. So what we have to really think is, you could say, okay, well, we do long and low on the lunge line for 6 months with the horse to build its back. It wouldn't build its back up. It has to be specific to what's going to make the back flex quietly over and over and over, but never so much that we damage it in the sense of overworking it, where we mentally damage her because she fatigues and she can't do more and she starts to use the wrong muscles in her body, or we'll also damage her on a physical level where she fatigues, can't use the muscles, and starts to use the wrong muscles in the body, which makes the joints and the ligaments and the tendons work in a way that they shouldn't work, where we hit an injury. So for me, I'm always thinking, really the best is just quiet transition work, walk counters again, trot counters again, pirouette type work again. But that's my mindset with it. I don't know if you guys have maybe something different to add into that.
No, I think we all agreed that we were sitting here talking about it, that, you know, when a horse gets to a certain level that you can actually start to do the pirouette work, things like that where the horse is actually asking, you're asking the horse to carry a little more on the hind legs, definitely will help improve the strength in the back. But again, you know, here we are, we're given a horse with a lovely work ethic and a little long in the back. I don't think that's going to stop her career. But I have another question for you here, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Pertaining to the gray horse with generally very expressive front leg and not so active in the hind legs. I think that often people do get hung up on the fact that if a horse has an active front leg, they think the hind leg isn't active. But if in a case like this where the horse can carry itself, which I think she's proven to doing very well, and also the changes were very clean, I think that with time and improvement and just overall good training, that I enjoy this horse.
Yeah, me too.
One of the questions is, how is the stretchy circle supposed to be? And there are several components of the stretch that are important from a judge's point of view. When they usually are done on a circle, even in the five-year-olds and also in our lower level test, there's a stretchy circle almost in every test. And what we are looking for is the horse's willingness, when the rider allows it, to follow the allowance of the hand down and forward with his nose, to actually stretch his whole top line and to stay connected as much as possible. Now, the younger the horse, the more difficult this is, because he's learning to change his balance according to the rider's wishes, not because he's deciding to do it. And then he's not supposed to speed up. He's not supposed to lose his bend, keep his cadence the same, and of course, in the transitions, as I said, chew the reins out of the rider's hands. Then the transitions, the horse is supposed to accept the fact that the rider says, okay, now come back
and now
here.
Stretch him again. And try to get his nose out.
Back on the aids, raise up a little bit, and don't try to run away from under me when I ask you to come back.
Stretch.
It is a very, very difficult exercise. It's difficult to do. And it's also one that is vital for having control over and exercising and suppling the horse's top line.
There's another question that came in. Do you recommend cross training, such as trail riding, swimming, Euro walker, etc.? I have a 5-year-old Turkana horse. How often do you feel he should be ridden? 5 to 6 days a week, he's in good shape and happy. I think 5 to 6 days a week, he should be happy. It's all good. You're on a good track for that age horse. You know, building up the fitness of young horses, I think that's just, we could have a few days to talk about that and hear ideas from other professionals and all get together and talk about that, because often just working in this rectangle isn't in their best interest, harder and harder and more and more. So yes, I'm a big fan of hills if they're available. I think hills are great for horses. Personally, we do have an exerciser at home, a walker, and we also are fortunate enough to have, we have a water treadmill, and I really, really like it. But I know that everyone's not able to have that in their backyard, and it's not a must at all. But any way we can think of to get fitness without them thinking it's just work, 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 work. But let's remember that that fitness is just body condition. We still have to do the work necessary under saddle to tune the muscles, the back carrying strength, all those things. We can't just use hills and just use an aquapacer and just use those things. The good riding is the most important thing. There was another question about how long should a four-year-old canter in the warm-up? Very, very difficult question to give you a clear answer on. I hope I had said this a little bit earlier today about, in my session, that warm-up is for a purpose. So the horse should canter long enough in the warm-up that you feel it can do its work. If that's 2 minutes, if that's whatever frame it is, explore and just say, you know what, my horse feels ready for work. Then warm-up is done. That's different than a day you're just going to ride elasticity and stretching for the horse without concentration. The horse can go for half an hour with just nice, with walk breaks, with nice elasticity. But if you stretch them too long and then expect them to work, then you can get in trouble.
So here's the question. Some people approach the pirouette in the haunches in and some in the shoulder in. What do you think? Actually, in schooling the pirouette, whatever works for the horse is what we do. Can be very pragmatic here. But when it comes to showing, you cannot approach it in either one. The only thing you can do to fake those judges out a little bit is a shoulder four. But don't try your haunches in. It isn't working. So you can teach the horse in a haunches in if that's easier for him, and I use it a lot. But then you have to also teach him to go straight, to go a little haunches in, and then to go absolutely straight and do that canter in place business when you keep him straight, and they really, that's hard on a horse. But that's when they really advance. And we don't do that with horses that are learning. We don't torture them to go, they would just stop. They would just run out of power and collapse behind. But when they really, really are ready and muscle, then you can ride them completely straight in almost a cantering place, and they can hold that balance. And that's really what, as judges, we look for the horse to come in straight, then do his pirouette with a little flexion in the direction of travel, and then move off straight again. And that's what makes it so hard. But, and you can approach it in a tiny shoulder four and get away with it because the horse looks straight to the eye that's looking at it, but you can't do it at the haunches in. Only when you practice, you know, and train.
We had a question. That red light. Yes. How are the four-year-old classes judged? Well, like all the young horse classes, they have several categories. You get a score for the walk, the trot, the canter, the submission, and general impression. And you all understood about the walk, trot, and canter. In the submission, we count things like the suppleness, the attentiveness to the rider, the bendability, how does the horse act if you ask for a turn on the haunches, lack of resistance or resistance. You get a mark for all that. The general impression is more when the judges, they all sit together, you know, and we talk about this. And we think about this particular horse, is this a horse that we believe is going to go on in the sport? Is this a horse that will go all the way to the top and eventually show up in Grand Prix in a way that doesn't look strained, or will it be able to be even a superstar? So that's how we use the different categories. So it's not all about gaits.
The question was, at what age do you recommend starting the young horse, specifically with the larger breeds? Again, in general, and everything's in general. In general, I would think the spring of the three-year-old year is a nice time to start the horses. Spring of the three-year-old year. It's more common in Europe to start them at 2.5, but there's a lot of pressure on them in Europe to start them at 2.5. And I would say that a smaller horse that's fit and balanced and all that, if you want to start lunging at 2.5 towards the end of the year, you could do that. I'm more of a fan of 3. I just think they get a little bit more set up on their bodies and ready for things. When I had to do large groups of horses to start, and we had a mixture of stallions, mares, geldings, the whole 9 yards, we often did the mares first because I liked to know what they were like to ride before I bred them. And then we would breed them 1 year and then see how they produced, and then we would decide if they were a riding horse or a breeding mare. But I think the riding helped me decide who I wanted to breed them to. So we always did the mares first when they were 3. Before the breeding season started, and we tried to breed them around May, April, May, something like that. So we had a couple of months under saddle. The Stallions, we would start earlier, like late 2.5, just because they had pressure on them to get them ready for inspections and things. So they'd start lunging at 2.5 with muscles and all those things, and then start riding them a little bit at 2.5 late in the year, and then back off in the winter, not even ride them. We'd work on the mares then, and then we'd start the Stallions back again. So they had a few months to just take it easy. But again, if you have, you know, specifically to a larger breed, I mean, big horses, I think we have to be careful. The joints are set up and things like that, but also don't let them get too mature because they're getting smarter and more powerful. So, you know, I think starting horses correctly, you don't have to really work them that hard. You have to work them smart. And then once they're started, you can take a break again. I mean, 60 days or 90 days or something to know something, and then put them back out in the field again. That's time well spent, I think. And I think the thing we have to be careful about is that we think it's a continuation all the time. As soon as I start them, okay, we're going to keep going, and I've got all these goals, and, you know, I get excited, and I'm going to go take on this and take on that. Well, I think sometimes stepping back is a good thing. I mentioned that today with the first horse with Lencia, with the four-year-old. I was so proud of her. What a smart decision, just to give that horse a break after the national championships for a couple months. And he is a younger-looking horse. He's not that mature yet. I thought that was just fantastic. Hope that answers the question from whoever asked it.
There was another question asked. Mine was about grinding teeth. If we have a three-year-old that's grinding the teeth, any suggestions? Yes and no. Yes, in the way that they can learn it as a habit when they're concentrating. It has nothing to do with discomfort in their bodies or something that's being asked too much of. It's a concentration thing. And if you want to, you can use gum bits or something like that they chew more so they don't learn that habit. So in some cases, I think horses grind because they're concentrating. And other times, you can listen to it if it's really specific and you can correlate and track a consistency. Maybe the horse has some pain, but I'm a fan that I don't really listen that much to the grinding. I think when you pay attention to it, it becomes worse in some cases. I just try to give gum bits and keep going and see what's up. Sometimes and go through that stage. But again, I don't have a black and white answer on that one.
And to add a judge's point of view, it used to be considered a problem with the grinding of teeth. Whenever you heard it, we finally got smarter. And of course, the trainers know that what Scott just said is very true. A horse can sometimes go better when it's grinding his teeth. That's when he really gets into the work. And usually, it goes away. When the horse is a little tense about one movement, he will do it. And 6 months later, he's comfortable at that movement, and the grinding just stops. But if you let it bother you when you ride, and you get tense because they do it, then they tend to play it against you. So both judges and riders can somewhat ignore it unless, as Scott said, it is you think it's pain-related at some specific movement.
No, I totally agree with that. I think a lot of times when you're starting a horse and you're starting to put a little more pressure, a little more intense training, then those kind of things show up for a short period of time. But I agree. A lot of times if you ignore it and go ahead and just go about your business, it usually resolves itself. And there are going to be horses that are just teeth grinders, but that is something that, you know, we hear it. If you ever go to the big shows in Europe, there's a lot of horses that grind their teeth that are doing very well. So it's not something we love, but something that not always can be fixed.
Scott, just as these ones are starting, we had a good question that we got while we were up top, which was, what age and when do you know when to start with the double bridle?
Great question. That would be a fun one with a lot of people around to discuss that, like we have now. I really feel there's not an age. There is a stage. So this may sound a little bit contrary. If I was to take the very, very diplomatic approach and go straight forward, I'd say, you know what, I really like them to do everything in the snaffle really well before a double bridle, in terms of teaching all the basic body work of collection, lateral work. But there are some horses who really respond beautifully to the double bridle. But like every tool, it's the hands that it's in. It's the hands that it's in. So if I have a very skilled rider and a double bridle is really going to help a late five-year-old coming into six, and the horse goes dramatically better in the double bridle, I don't feel it's an excuse. I feel it helps the horse. I don't want to see a tight curb chain. I don't want to see the use of the curb chain. I want to see that just the pressure points help that horse a lot. I wouldn't be afraid to put it in the late five-year-old. I don't do that often, but I have done it. So again, it's kind of in the stage. I would say for sure towards the late six, early seven-year-old year, I think they should start to learn it if it's a horse who's on a normal track. But I always want to be a little bit careful about to say exactly, I feel good to start it at this age. But I think when a horse is going with nice third-level work, starting fourth-level work, and you want to try the double bridle in your horse when it's very mature, I think you have the right to try it.
And, you know, in the end, it all comes down to good riding and good horsemanship. And whenever you start fixing the bits and fixing the equipment and changing the saddles and getting with the latest fad on everything, you're probably looking to avoid the real problem, which has to do with your riding.
Really good question, whoever asked it about nosebands. I'm a fan of trying to work from simplicity, and I prefer a regular Cavesson noseband with a flash is my noseband of preference. However, from there, I would say I do use drop noseband. Sometimes they look old-fashioned, they don't look good, but I'm not such a fan of looking good. I like a clear purpose. I like a drop noseband on some horses, and for different reasons, not for a specific reason. If they just like the pressure better in the drop noseband for a while, it can just be a pressure point. For example, some young horses, or some horses in general, but young horses, when they're a little bit nervous, they're chewing a lot, and they can get their gums a little bit sore by their teeth, where the normal Cavesson can go. A flash is below the bit, it can rest that skin. So sometimes they're steadier just to rest that skin because the teeth are changing in the young horse's mouth. So I vary it quite a bit, but
I want to make sure, which is how the flash is supposed to work, I want the flash on there to help hold the bit still, so that there's less ability for him to move the bit around in his mouth and change the contact. The flash is not there on the bridles to actually do anything to keep the horse's mouth closed. The Cavesson is supposed to work up high on the jaw to help support a quiet mouth, but not supposed to crank the mouth closed. The flash itself, the drop part of the noseband, is only really there to hold the bit in one place in the horse's mouth. So as we talked about with Ariana with it, she said when you put the flash on, he gets a little bit fussy. And I asked her the other day with it about saying when you take him home next week, I want you to start to think about it and start to work with it, put it on and leave it totally loose. Give him a little padding under there. Let him kind of get comfortable with it, because he does have that tendency to be a little bit chompy in his mouth. And it's not that we're going to crank his noseband closed to eliminate it, because the more in that way, if we create the wrong kind of tension, he's going to be more funny about the contact, more worried in his mouth. So I have to let him.
Totally agree. I think when you have a horse that is a little bit, like you said, a little chomping at the bit, a little active, I think, like you said, it doesn't need to be tight, but the one thing you don't want is the horse to start getting more active as you start to put more pressure on. Then you start to become with, you know, it starts to become more of a habit for the horse to get more active in the mouth. So I think I would recommend a flash too as well. I think it would be beneficial.
And also one question. What would you do with a horse that always moves away from the side you carry the whip, even when it's held properly and only used to reinforce forward?
That's a good one. So you guys heard the question, what do you do with a horse that is always going away from the whip? And this is where you have to think. You have to be creative. You have to bring other thoughts into your work, and you have to be little mad scientists. I read a little bit about the Global Forum this year. I didn't go, but some of the stuff I read about what Kara was saying, and I saw that Buck movie this year. I don't know if you guys seen the Buck Brenneman story. I like him, don't like, whatever. But interesting horsemanship. You can learn a lot from different people. It's one of those things. If you have a horse, to me, that's a little bit worried of the whip and is moving away from the whip, and it's not accepting it. So I have to do work on the ground, not on his back, but actually on the ground to go, this whip isn't a huge deal. You can like it. I had a four-year-old, my own horse. She has back problems, so we've retired her. But I did with her as a four-year-old, as a little baby, in a halter. She's terrified of whips. And even we broke her. We didn't do anything to her with it, but scared of the whip. And I did a lot with her in the evenings when I'd hand walk her. And I would just take her in the arena, a pocket full of carrots and sugar. And I took the whip, a long piaf whip, and I just petted her, fed her, led her around more, pet her a little more, fed her more, led her around more, and went around for hours. I mean, over months and months in time. She actually learned to do little half steps in a halter, just playing with the whip, and learned to kind of go, okay, the whip is no problem. But I think when something like that comes into play, you have to actually go outside the box just a little bit and go, I need to get him a little bit calmer, quieter, just not thinking that the whip is going to do anything. Sometimes you do end up with one that's terrified of the whip and you've never used it hard on them. They're sensitive. That does happen. But you do have to think, every horse, my thought is that all have to learn to accept a whip. Because at some point in time you might need it. You have to be able to carry it. So if they do have that reaction, you do want to take the time to get them comfortable with it.
There was a question here about discussed use of the spur to influence the ribs, abs, and hind legs.
So that was a good question. You guys heard it in the audience. Yeah, discuss use of the spur to influence ribs, abs, and hind legs. Perfect. I have a belief. I've never used my spur to make the horse go forward. I use my leg. If the horse doesn't respond to my leg, I follow through with the whip. I want my horse sensitized to my leg, so I don't need a spur to make my horse move. That doesn't make sense. I have to have big spurs. I can't make him trot. Well, it's supposed to be light, and you're supposed to have invisible aids later. So if you use your spur to make him go, it's pretty obvious that you're making him go. But we use the spur to reinforce, the same way the whip reinforces. Here's my leg, I ask you to go. You didn't go, touching you with the whip. Simple. Horses learn that on a lunge line, right? We break them right as young horses. They know a lunge whip. Say, terut, doesn't trot, you shake the lunge whip out. They learn that. So we get on them when we're breaking them as riders. I don't know, Scott, you can tell me too if it's you don't agree. So we get on them as young horses. They've learned to use the whip. They learn that from the lunge line. So we get on them, we put our helmets on, we're all ready to go, and we ask them to move, and they don't go. We don't have spurs on, which is right. And we start kicking, kick, 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 chasing them around. And we're all scared to touch them with the whip because we think they're going to buck us off. It doesn't make any sense. They have no comprehension of what the leg is supposed to do. They know our voice and they know the whip. They should be quietly trained to that when they're getting broke. So that shouldn't change. We don't go later, oh, I'm changing the rules now when you're this age so I can do it. So what I say is the spur reinforces our bending aids. It might reinforce a moment of engagement of a hind leg, because engagement of a hind leg under the horse's belly, as it steps under, the belly moves slightly over away from that leg, which creates bend. The rib cage hollows. The body hollows, sorry. So engagement creates bend. There's other ways we can bend the neck too. That also bends the horse a little bit. But we use the spur to say to him, here's my leg needing you to bend your body. And if you don't bend your body right or move in that way, I'm going to use the spur a little bit to reinforce that. Not send you forward, but take that hind leg and give it more reach up under so the body hollows. Does that make sense? Yeah? So for me, I think spur for bending or engagement. The two are really the same if you're in a bending moment. And the whip for forward.
Yesterday there was a question regarding the lunge line over the head or under the chin. Someone had asked that question. Personally, I prefer it over the pole. However, if I have a very disobedient horse, there's a clip that's made that attaches to both rings of the bit, and you can attach the lunge line underneath that. If I have a very disobedient horse, I prefer to put it there to work through some kind of an issue, and then over the pole for nice proper lunging. I think the pole is very sensitive, and if I have a horse who's got resistance issues going on, that the lunging is being used as a training tool to fix a problem, I prefer not to mess with the horse's pole.
Here was one that was sent in today that says, how do you feel about the position of the curb bit in the double bridle? In some, the curb bit was more vertical than in others, making it look like there's a lot more contact. Well, a lot of that depends on the curb chain. If you don't do the curb chain up enough, then the bit rotates more in the mouth and you'll get this look. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the rider is necessarily being that much harder on the curb. It's just the adjustment of where you put the curb chain to whether it, how much rotation you get in the bit. So that, I hope that answers that question.
There's a question about bits on four-year-olds. And it, I think this, the question was, if I remember how it was stated, is that we see commonly a loose ring snaffle. Is that a bit that's preferred? You know, to be honest, I'm really simple. I try not to get too varying left and right about what's right and what's wrong. I like to start simple. And then from simple, if that's not working, then I start to experiment a bit more. So like when we said about nose bands, a normal Cavesson with a flash is where I start. When I start a horse younger than four, when we first back them, I personally prefer a bit that's not a loose ring, because they don't know how to be straight yet. They don't know contact yet, and the bit can pull through their mouths in a loose ring. So until they've learned, a bit that has more of a cheek piece helps them get more stable in the contact. I prefer that in lunging them and starting them under saddle. And then I transfer to a simple loose ring snaffle. And again, from there, I pick up varieties, but there's not a preferred way or a must-be way at all. Again, I think horses are such individuals, we have to explore.
This session will continue next week with part two of Ask the Experts from the 2011 Annual Symposium. This podcast is available for download on iTunes. For more information about the USDF, please visit the website at usdf.org.